Hey there! If you like true crime stories and you love being in the great outdoors, you have come to the right place. I'm Tara, your host. Welcome to Crime Off the Grid. Hi, everyone. Welcome to the Crime Off the Grid podcast. I'm Tara, and today I have a special guest with me. John Goodwin is here, and he's had a very distinguished career with the National Park Service and beyond. He's the author of the book Echoes of the Badge, Stories from a National Park Service Career. Welcome, John.
Hi, thank you. Thanks for having me.
Yeah, it's so good to have you joining us today. Well, rather than me reading off your bio, tell us where you've worked and a little bit about how or even why you got started with the National Park Service.
Yeah, so it started a long time ago, not in a galaxy far, far away, but it did start. I grew up in Colorado, and my dad used to take us on road trips every summer for vacation, and we used to go to all the national parks in the West, and probably my favorite was Great Sand Dunes National. Well, at that time it was National Monument, now it's a national park. But
yeah,
but I tell you, just being there and looking at the rangers, you know, we can all of us who were rangers, we can look back at the little kids that look up to you, and you know, they want to wear your flat hat, and I was one of those kids.
Yep.
Well, the years went by. My dad had a series of strokes. You know, the vacations, you know, to the parks ended. So, you know, it wasn't until probably my mid-20s when I just started dreaming of the national parks again. And it was one of those things where it's like I really want to work, you know, at a national park and make it a career. So, getting back to you know, my first position with the Park Service was working at an entrance booth in Rocky Mountain National Park, and I was at the Beaver Meadows entrance station. Moved on from there to, I guess, a promotion of sorts to remit courier at Rocky. And then from there, you know, went to Santa Rosa, seasonal training, and then got my law enforcement start at Mount Rainier, worked there, you know, seasonally for a few years. And then,
yeah.
Then I had to get my status, like most of us, you know, you got to make a sacrifice. So I went with, at that time it was US INS immigration. So I got a position there as an agent, went to FLETC, got out of there as quick as I could, and then went to work at Everglades, followed by North Cascades, and then finally ended up at Golden Gate National Recreation Area.
Yeah. Well, for people listening who might not have understood the word status,
yeah,
it's okay. You know, the National Park Service is one of those few government agencies that can't get a permanent job unless you're permanent. And, you know, almost all of us have had some starts where we did things that we didn't start out being park rangers. Sometimes
they
do
right.
Today.
Yeah,
right. My status job was an administrative clerk. So mm-hmm. You get your first permanent job, and then you know, you hope to lateral on to get your law enforcement career started. So yeah, we can all relate to that if those of us who started in the Park Service.
Yep.
Yeah. To interrupt you there.
Oh no, thanks for the clarification, because you're right, a lot of people think, oh, it's easy, you know, you just apply for a job and you're a park ranger. Well, as a seasonal, and there's less seasonal positions now, but certainly, you know, back in those days, you're absolutely right. Like, you had to do what you had to do to get your foot in the door. And, yeah.
Yeah. Well, what did you do for immigration?
So I was an agent. It was an immigration agent position. It sounds fun, but for the most part, though, I went to state prisons, and I would interview people in the prison to see if they were either in the country, you know, illegally, or if they were residents. And then if they were residents, you know, I would have to look at how many felony convictions they would have and misdemeanor convictions, put a case together, send it to the magistrate to see if he or she would, you know, mm-hmm. report the person. And chances are good they wouldn't. A person that was in the country without doing a proper border inspection, for those matters, that as soon as they completed their prison term, we'd go pick them up at the state prison and then put them on a border patrol bus, and they'd be usually sent down to Mexico. So yeah, it was interesting. We did a few raids at a few manufacturing plants. Believe it or not, the people who would rat on the people who were working at those plants were the owners of the plants. So they would get into a money pinch. They wouldn't have money for the salary, so they had turned themselves in, knowing that the fine, the potential fine would be less than paying the salary. So I worked with a great group of special agents and supervisory special agent in charge, and we got wind of that pretty quickly. And so what we started doing when we got we went on these raids at these plants is we'd put all the the employees, the people that were illegally in the country, we'd put them there on the curb. And then, the supervisory special agent would say to the owner of the plant, you need to get your bookkeeper out here right now, and you need to pay these people every penny that you owe them. And of course, the owners would balk and, oh, we're not going to do that. You need to do your job. And it's like, no, we're going to call the press and they're going to come and they're going to do a little segment on you. And so, those raids stopped pretty soon after that, because the word got out like, we're going to have to pay salaries. So
it was interesting.
Yeah. Yeah. It was an interesting job. It certainly wasn't a park ranger, mm-hmm. It was mostly sitting in an office and putting together cases, but it was a foot in the door.
Right. Well, so then you just said when I interrupted you, you went to Everglades after that. Was your first permanent Park Service job?
It was. Yeah. I arrived. I moved from California because I was working in the San Jose field office for immigration. And I drove cross country. And, you're kind of second guessing your decision when you drive. It was the first toll booth that I got to on the Florida Turnpike. And the lady took a look at my California plate and saw it was loaded to the brim with stuff. And she's like, basically, why in God's sake are you moving here? And I'm like, I'm going to Everglades. I got a position. And she's like, good. Like, no, she's like, good luck to you. But thankfully I arrived in the wintertime. So, the mosquitoes were much less than they are in the summer. And again, great group of people I worked with at Everglades. They made me feel at home. Really good opportunity. Good place to start. Yeah.
Good. And then what'd you do?
Well, after getting struck by lightning, I decided to move on to North Cascades. It was going to be, obviously my wife did not like the Everglades with the heat, humidity, and the mosquitoes. Mm-hmm. So, went to North Cascades, better position, I thought at the time. And, it was going to be a little bit cooler place, a little bit less mosquitoes and stuff like that. But it all went well until one day I was out in patrol when a big old bear, came to the plate glass window of the place I was living with my wife and my infant son at Hosamine. And the bear was like looking at her on its hind legs through the window. So when I got back from my patrol, my wife was like, I think I'm moving back to San Francisco. So then I had to get a position at Golden Gate to be with my family.
Yeah. Well, that makes sense. Well, let's circle back. You said, and things were going good until you got struck by lightning. So, hey, can you tell that story about the time you were struck by lightning in Everglades?
Yeah, absolutely. So it was right before Hurricane Floyd was due to hit the shores of Florida. And of course, everyone was saying, no, it's going to, veer due north. It was on a westerly track, but we couldn't take any chances. So what we did is we, got into patrol boats. Some of us went into Whitewater Bay. Some of us went into Florida Bay. That was me. And, started talking to people who were out there in the houseboats, on yachts or whatever. Hey, there's a hurricane coming, blah, blah, blah. And of course, they all had access to the marine band, and Coast Guard was putting out advisories, but you don't want to take any chances. So you want to let people know. But as soon as I left port that day, and this was back in 1999, as soon as I left the Flamingo port, it was just one thunderstorm after another. Hurricane Floyd was, I think it's still one of the biggest in size hurricanes that ever struck the United States. It was enormous. So every hurricane and tropical storm, they spit out these pretty big thunderstorms ahead of as it's approaching. It just spits them out, right? So yeah, that was the whole day on the water, was avoiding one thunderhead after another. And, you know, when you're on open water, it's relatively easy. You can watch, you know, the direction of the thunderstorm and everything, you know, look at the anvil and see what direction it's going. So I was doing good until I got down to around the area of the Florida Keys. And it, all of a sudden I hear a loud boom from behind me. And I thought my motor blew up.
Yeah.
And, you know, because I was so busy looking at the nautical chart and trying to avoid getting stuck in the mud. I didn't notice. It was pitch black. And so the lightning had probably struck right behind my motor. I was pretty well shaken up by that. So I motored into the Keys themselves, and there was like a little marina that you could boat into. They had a restaurant there and everything like that. So I motored in, filled up the boat, ran inside to get out of the storm, and just sat there looking at the Weather Channel saying, you know, I got to make it back, because, you know, I didn't have many choices. I couldn't leave the boat there. The hurricane was a couple of days away. So, you know, looking at the Weather Channel, calling on the radio back to Flamingo, back to the home port, you know, I finally figured out, okay, it looks like the clouds are still around, but not much lightning activity. So got into the patrol boat and started heading kind of roughly west by north, kind of northeast, kind of navigating through Florida Bay, and was going through a channel called Man of War Channel. And Florida Bay, I should backtrack, Florida Bay is very, very shallow. And even more shallow when a hurricane is passed, because usually it's just mud, right? But but on a high tide, you're generally okay. If it's like low tide, you've got to stick to the channel. So I was sticking through a channel, navigating my way through, and all of a sudden, just like right in front of me, just beautiful bright light, white light. And then, you know, just a really good, peaceful feeling, like, hey, this doesn't feel so bad being, you know, killed, right? And, and then when I came to, I kind of wished I was back in that nice, beautiful feeling of that soft white light, because I was in so much pain. I was on the deck of my boat. And what's really interesting, the boat had made a 180. So I was steaming south now instead of going north.
Wow.
I had no idea, no memory of what happened. It could have been the reflex, you know, because I had one hand on the wheel, one hand on the throttle. So it could have been the reflex when I got hit by lightning that I just jerked the wheel. But, you know, I don't know. You know, I kind of wish I would have known how the boat got that way. But so I had to pick myself off the deck, and it was just in so much pain. My body was just racked with pain. And, you know, the first thing is turn off the motor. You know, the second thing is trying to figure out where the heck I was. So using the charts, I found out that I was miles away from Man of War Channel, south of
Man of War. Wow.
Yeah. And then I had a radio, you know, back to Flamingo that I got struck by lightning. The Rangers there wanted to come out and get me, but I could not, I couldn't put anyone else in danger. So, you know, I got to the point where I could actually stand on my right leg and use my right arm again. And, you know, it didn't take any of the pain away, but at least I could use them. And I just started just motoring my way again back through Man of War Channel, and eventually hit Flamingo Port. They loaded me up in the park ambulance, took me into Homestead to where the nearest hospital was. And, you know, of course, they did the EEG, the EKG, and, you know, checked me from head to toe. And, you know, crazy as it sounds, the only visible injury was on my left shoulder. And it was this weird looking scar that, that's usually when a lightning strike happens. These scars, they pop up, they go away after a couple of days, but they're really weird to look at. Anyway, that's apparently where the lightning entered into my left shoulder.
Wow.
And went across, you know, the collarbones or the shoulder blades, mm-hmm. you know, went right where the area of the heart is, obviously.
And that's so close. Yeah.
You know, when the doc was looking at all the lab tests, he's like, well, you know, you're in good condition, except for the scar on your left shoulder. But, you know, he couldn't say anything if the heart had stopped or anything like that. And I have no idea how long I was out or anything. So, but, you know, that just, it's one thing, you know, you get back, you go to the hospital, you know, you get sent back home, but then that's really where the PTSD journey kind of started at that point.
So you mentioned PTSD, and you mentioned in your book that is something that you suffered from. So can you talk about the incidents that were maybe the most significant contributors to PTSD, or would you say it was just cumulative stress?
You know, I think cumulative stress was a big factor. you know, it definitely did start after the first lightning strike. But then, unfortunately, when I was at North Cascades, I got struck again by lightning.
Oh, my gosh. I did read that. I'm not.
Yeah. It was it was a little bit less frightening than the first one. But so, yeah, I was on Ross Reservoir. I was shuttling fire crew, you know, back and forth all day, you know, taking them into some of the boat in spots and stuff. And they were going back there doing some controlled burns and trail maintenance and whatever. And I'd shuttle the last of the crew, and I was trying to make my way back to Hozamine, and just the sky got dark again. And when you're on Ross Reservoir, there's not many places to go. It's just like being on Florida Bay. I mean, you could maybe boat into a nearby key. They call it keys there. They're like small islands, but that's not going to give you any protection. And Ross Reservoir, I mean, maybe you could boat to the side of the shore and tie for your boat on a tree branch. You know, good luck with that. But so I made the decision to just motor it, you know, and try to get to Hozamine. And this time I saw the lightning bolt hit the water. You know, this time there's no beautiful, bright, soft light. I mean, it was like I just had barely enough time to say, oh, didn't get out the
out
the rest of the word.
Yeah.
And my hand got blown off the throttle.
Oh, my gosh.
Oh, yeah. But thankfully, this time it stopped for some reason at the shoulder blade. So on the right arm, it just, you know, like the pain didn't go past that. But my right arm was just hanging to my side like a, you know, just like a noodle, right? Like a limp noodle, just hanging there. Like I couldn't raise it. I couldn't do anything. So I made my way finally back to Hozamine. Crew got there. They brought me into the cabin that I was there. And my wife and my son, they had already left to go back to San Francisco. So, you know, they did the best job they could. They, checked the heart, you know, blood pressure and everything like that. That was sky high, obviously. But the only choice I had back then was to either boat down the Ross Reservoir with obviously another ranger taking me to the hospital. But lightning was everywhere at that time. So that was ruled out, of course. And then, you know, get onto the like an unimproved dirt road and drive into Canada, get to Hope, Canada, maybe, and get some help there. But I didn't want to get into a patrol truck and drive on a bumpy road. And then the third option, which was ruled out because of the weather, was a helicopter, you know, flown in, but couldn't do that. So it was a night of misery, sitting in the cabin, no sleep at all. And, you know, the PTSD really came back hard at that time. Then, of course, you know, you try to fool yourself and say, oh, you know, I'm cured of PTSD. And obviously, back then, there wasn't much treatment for PTSD. And a lot of people didn't even want to refer to it as anything. But, it's trauma. You'll get over it. And it's like, well, not really. So, to answer your question, it was cumulative. Not only those events, but when I did make it to Golden Gate National Recreation Area, area that I was working at, mostly south of the Golden Gate Bridge, you're exposed to a lot of suicides. A lot of dead bodies that wash up on shore from people who jumped off the bridge or jump off cliffs, whatever. So it was dealing with that, you know, just cumulative, a lot of stuff that just came washing over me. And it was a 10-year battle fighting it.
Right.
Yeah.
You mentioned in your book that you'd been assaulted more than once and you'd gotten some concussions. And then you spoke about a breaking point. So I was wondering if you could speak to that.
Yeah, I'd be happy to. Yeah, so in 2009, I suffered two pretty severe assaults. One was by a lady who was suffering from a mental health crisis, and I had heard her calling for help. I was in the Land's End area calling for help. Sounds like the woman's voice was coming from these kind of like a bush area. And I know that people had camped in that area and stuff like that. So I called in backup. Backup was heading towards me, and she was just letting out these blood curdling screams. So, I kind of stuck my head into this area, and I knew that there was a clearing inside, kind of stuck to see, you know, if this woman was okay, what was going on. As soon as I stuck my head in there, I was hit right over the head by her metal crutch.
And, wow.
I didn't lose consciousness, and I fought back, eventually pulled out my baton, and pretty crazy fight. You know, she was swinging that crutch like a club, and I eventually snapped her crutch in half with my baton, and then she scurried out of the area, backup was still really slow getting there and everything like that. So I'm pursuing her and I'm thinking, you know, she's going to jump off a cliff or something. And, you know, eventually she made her way down to this really secluded beach, tried to drown herself two times in the, she tried to drown herself two times in the ocean there. And Coast Guard, believe it or not, Coast Guard was there almost faster than my backup because I had called dispatch like she was heading towards the water. But the waves brought her in both times. And the second time my backup finally got there and she was still fighting us. Like she was fighting us tooth and nail, two of us like trying to detain her. So we finally got her back up the cliff, back up to a parking lot. She got, you know, sent via ambulance to the hospital, you know, for treatment and everything like that. And for me, you know, another ride to the hospital, you know, one of, I think it was 20 or so that I experienced there at Golden Gate. So, got
there. You said 20 assaults? What, 20 or so what?
20 hospital visits. This was all from, every one of them was caused by assaults, fighting with people, you know, trying to get people detained. I don't know if I'd already mentioned, but yeah, you know, Golden Gate, especially south of the Golden Gate Bridge, you deal with everything that San Francisco Police Department deals with. So, and you kind of get the worst of the worst because there's nowhere else to go, right? There's the ocean. So where are they going to go? But except to the national parks. So yeah, 20 times to the hospital, two surgeries, you name it. I mean, I think every body part of me was injured at one time.
Well, a little known fact, most people don't realize, but the National Park Service law enforcement rangers have a higher, what's the stat? Are assaulted more in the course of doing their duties than any other federal law enforcement officer.
You're right. That's absolutely correct. Yeah. And number one, we're usually out there, usually by ourselves, right? I mean, even at a place like Golden Gate, where potentially you have a lot of backup, you got San Francisco Police. If you're working north of the Golden Gate Bridge, you got Marin County that can come in. But even then, I mean, for me, I mean, my career there, you know, it wasn't my entire career, it was a good chunk of it, but to get assaulted 20 times, and that doesn't include use of force. And I had over 50 use of forces when I was at Golden Gate.
Just at Golden Gate?
Yeah, everything. Just at Golden Gate. That's everything from drawing the pistol to using the baton to using the taser to pepper spray to hands-on knockdown, drag-down fights and stuff like that. So, yeah, so that was one of the two assaults in 2009. The second was by an older teenager that he was with his buddy smoking marijuana over by Fort Mason. I contacted them. Backup was coming. His friend was compliant, sat down on the ground when I asked him, and the other kid wasn't. So I came in to grab him, to pull him down to the ground, and I lost my footing. I ended up sliding down a small cliff with him on top of me and got to the bottom. I was hitting tree branches, rocks with my head.
Wow. This is just like in the movies. I'm seeing this in slow motion as you're describing it. I'm seeing this in slow motion, but continue.
no worries. So we got to the bottom of the cliff and I threw him off. He wanted to keep fighting, so I tased him and got control of him at that point. Park police got there as backup, and we ended up obviously arresting him. But, you know, the thing, I can accept that in my career, you know, but certainly all of us, well, a lot of us get assaulted and stuff like that. It happens, right? But it's the prosecution or lack thereof that really, you know, for me, having both those assaults in just a couple of months and dealing with the PTSD, that was just... You know, it was like one more thing to add into the PTSD grocery bag, right? You know,
so
by that time it was just filling over. So I, on the second one, you know, it happened at I was at such a low point. You know, I was at the end of the shift and I got a phone call just as I was putting my shotgun and my AR-15 into the safe at Fort Funston Ranger Station. And call was from a buddy and he's like, hey, you know, the person's not going to get prosecuted. Sorry to let you know. Wow. And everything just hit, you know, it was like,
and that blows me away. That's amazing. Yeah.
I know. It's just the reality of working in, you know, especially a urban park where there's a lot of assaults and you know, you get a DA's office or a, assistant U.S. attorney that just doesn't want to prosecute people. So, yeah, you know, it was a little known kind of a tidbit that, you know, at Golden Gate, we all knew that unless you had a broken bone or, you know, if you're killed in the line of duty by a subject, they probably wouldn't prosecute. That's that bad.
Wow.
And
it's not
just for Rangers or park police. That was for San Francisco police officers as well.
Interesting.
Yeah. So it hit me, that news hit me at the wrong time. And, you know, I came very close to ending my life that particular day, you know, when I was putting my weapons away in the safe. And, you know, it was like, everything you talk about, like the end of the life, when everything, you get these flashbacks of people, places, and like my whole life just flashed in front of me. And at the very last images were my wife and my son. And, you know, I just broke down. I broke down and I came into work the next day. I told my supervisor, I need help. Right. And his answer was kind of a typical thing in the park service we can all relate to. But his answer was, just patrol up here, the Marin headline, keep my eye on you. And I'm like,
right.
Keep your eye on me. Right.
Yeah. Seriously? What does that even mean?
Right. So I went to my chief ranger after. So I sat down at a computer. I'm like, you know, I need to see what's out there, what help is available. And the very first website that popped up was Police One. And on Police One, there was an ad for the West Coast post-trauma retreat. And I was like, oh, this sounds really good. And I looked into it and I notified my chief ranger and I said, can I attend this? And she said, absolutely. And I don't know if she paid out of pocket, if she was able to get money out of the budget to pay for it. But I did go and it saved my life. You know, it was the first time that I was able to be around peers. And, you know, there wasn't another ranger that was there, but, you know, there was highway patrol officer that was involved, you know, in a fatal shooting. There was a Forest Service person that had been involved in a burnover. You know, he'd gotten to a shelter, all of these officers and firefighters, they had gone through so much trauma. So, you know, it was so refreshing to be with people that had suffered, you know, not similar trauma, but, you know, we all experience different things, but just the fact that I could relate to somebody for like my first time in my career, you know, people who suffering, right?
Yeah. Yeah. Well, one thing that's rarely mentioned since we're talking about this is something called vicarious trauma. Mm-hmm. And you had actual direct trauma impacting you, but a lot of people in these types of jobs, particularly first responders, carry the trauma from those people who are directly impacted and not so much themselves. And so, you know, you see a lot of horrific things that others are going through, and then you carry that trauma on you. So that's that vicarious trauma. And that's a real thing too. And, you know, people can get PTSD from just that and that repeated cumulative stress in working with other people who have that direct trauma is something that, and I'm just glad that you've brought this out or mentioned this in your book, because it's something we hope that people don't feel that there's a stigma about. There always has been. And I just think hopefully today we're doing better about that. So people do feel comfortable getting help.
You know, I'm with you on that. I think at the start of my career, in 1990, it didn't exist. You didn't speak up about stuff. You know, even when the PTSD happened, you just didn't bring it up to coworkers, you know, and the treatment back then was either medication or, you know, they give you a pamphlet. Hey, you know, here's a pamphlet. How not to feel bad anymore. Right.
Right.
Or you get a counselor, you know, psychologist, psychiatrist that want to talk about your childhood. And you know, that's important. Don't get me wrong. You know, if you got trauma in your childhood, that's important. But I remember the first doc that I spoke to, I just wanted to talk about the doggone lightning bolt that came through my shoulder.
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah.
And, you know, and he just wanted to talk about childhood stuff. And I'm like, oh my God, you know, that session only lasted, well, one session. And then I'm like, I'm out of here. And then, you know, you talked about stigma, and it is getting better. I think we're able to maybe speak up a little bit more and to, not to get off the subject a little bit, but, you know, my role right now is a mayor in the town.
That's awesome.
Yeah, thanks. So, you know, we, I remember back a couple of years ago, you know, there was a lot of talk about things like, you know, defunding police, and even the little town that I'm in, there was even that talk that people were bringing that subject up. And we visited it during, you know, a few study sessions and everything like that. But a point that I wanted to drive through to the chief was there and the commander was there. I just wanted to say to him, look, let's get, you know, we need to have some EAP, right? We need to have something available for officers to keep good officers good, you know, and I don't care if it's a rookie officer that sees this chief acting a little bit not normal, right? Or saying and doing things that are out of the character of what the chief usually does. I want that rookie to be able to bring that to his or her attention, the chief's attention, and say, you're not doing so good, right? And vice versa, if the chief sees a rookie not doing good, you know, to bring that up. So long story short, we were able to, in the town of Colma, bring forward, and my commander was great. He was able to, and, you know, I was able to push through council, let's get money set aside for help, right? And this is 24/7, just like they have for the Park Service now. There's a number you can call, you can get 24/7 help, right? You can talk to somebody who understands what you're going through. And so I do see it changing. It's certainly not perfect, but we're getting to the point where I'm hoping that officers, rangers, you know, whoever, if you're working as a law enforcement officer, you can get the help you need and not walk around with this big stigma, you know, and have the other officers talking about you, or you don't get the promotions because, you know, oh, you have PTSD or whatever. So I think we're getting there. Yeah.
Well, something that you sort of alluded to so far, and it's something that's somewhat unique to working for and living in a national park, is how difficult it is to have a family in the National Park Service and to actually live together as a family. Yeah. And can you speak to your experience about that?
Absolutely. Yeah. So when I first started my career working Rocky and then going to Mount Rainier and even in Everglades, my wife and I were having a long distance relationship. I was very grateful. At that time, she was working for one of the airlines and I was able to get non-ref flights. So all you do is you pay taxes. You don't pay the cost of the airfare. So it's easy, except you got to wait for a seat to be open. But, you know, it worked out. We were able to see each other every couple of weeks, you know, when vacation time would come, you know, we'd try to match up her vacation with the airlines, my vacation with the Park Service, and at least spend some quality time. But I got to tell you, it's not easy. And I know there's a lot of men, you know, a lot of men, women, couples that are out there that suffer from this. And then if you throw a child in the mix, like I had Sean, you know, wife and I had Sean when we were at Everglades, transferred to North Cascades, and the living conditions, even when you're with your partner, you know, like you worked at Yellowstone and I know you can see some of these issues, but you know, you got to start looking at, school, like, when Sean was just an infant, it was like, okay, we'd either go on that, you know, I told you about the unimproved dirt road into Hope, Canada, but thankfully that put him to sleep when he was in the baby seat in the back. But even on the boat ride going down Ross, you know, I had to find the smallest PFD that I could put on the little guy, you know, and then I had to put him in a childcare and walk up a mile and a half to the road to get a shuttle to get back to our other house, you know, in the town of Diablo. So it is really challenging. And I know the divorce rate, you know, it's not just the divorce rate that's high among Park Service employees, but it's also couples breaking up because of this. It is so challenging.
Yeah. Yeah, it's hard to make it work at that distance. I mean, we were in the same park, but couldn't really live in the same, like, you know, miles, 70, 80 miles away in the same park.
Right.
And had to raise two boys with one of us gone. You know, I mean, it does work out. And it's funny because the National Park Service, we get used to that. And that seems very normal to us. And so people kind of like, how could you have done that? It's like, well, I don't know. It's normal. And when that's almost like you hire somebody and unless you can get both of them hired, you know, as a dual career, if it's a spouse coming, you're like, oh gosh, it's not going to go well because, you know, a spouse coming in, it's hard for them to get jobs in these remote places. And where do they go to school? Canada, you know, or whatever. So it's very, very hard.
It is. And then if your significant other is not even working for the Park Service, then it becomes one of these things, you know, you live and you breathe, especially when you're living and working in a park, when you don't have the opportunity to live outside. You know, all your friends are Park Service. You know, you're wearing the same uniform every day. You step out and you're in a national park, and you just hope that your significant other can kind of just, you know, drag you away from that and say, "Hey, let's get some friends who aren't Park Service people."
Or it's very hard to do.
Or maybe even, can we leave the park for the weekend and go in town? You know, and
maybe might have to, so you don't get pulled into work.
Oh, I hear you. When I was in Flamingo in Everglades, in that subdistrict, you know, huge subdistrict, right? And I remember. We were down a few positions, and it was my buddy Bruce and I were like the only two law enforcement rangers working in a 500,000, you know, square mile district, right?
Wow.
And so it would be everything from, you know, if I knew Bruce was working, I'm like, oh, you know, no beers tonight, or can't have that margarita when I'm off duty.
Exactly.
So, you know, because when he would call for backup, it would be me.
And
you know, the nearest backup was Pine Island Ranger Station, which was 50 miles away. So it's not only dealing with significant others, but even if you don't have a partner, trying to make a go of it in the national parks, especially when it's isolated or somewhat isolated, it is so challenging.
Yeah. Well, I am so happy to have gotten to read your book. And I got to say, I rarely read books these days, but I bought your book on Amazon and read it in a really short period of time, so it's an easy read.
Thank you.
I did want to ask you, why did you want to write this book?
You know, for a couple of reasons. The first reason was to put all of these stories that I've been gathering over almost 30 years, put it together in a book format for my my family and friends.
Yeah.
You know, they had heard a lot of these stories. I just wanted to put it down for them, you know, in book format, or they can go on to Kindle, whatever they want to do, an ebook. So that was the biggest reason. The number two reason is I just wanted to, earlier we had talked about the stigma of PTSD, but I wanted to throw those stories, you know, the stories that related to PTSD and the journey that I went through. I wanted to throw those out to people to hopefully inspire people to, you know, get help. If you need help, go get help, right? And maybe a person would be reading my book at some time and be at a really low point in their lives and read it and say, wow, like he got through it, right? You know, I can do the same thing, right? So that was important. And the third reason was to hopefully educate the public over what park rangers do and the many hats that we have to wear, the adventures that we go through. I mean, there's a lot of good stories out there. You know, I'm sure all of us could write a book, you know, the all retired rangers, you know, because we go through so much. So it's educating people on, you know, especially I found working at Golden Gate National Recreation Area, urban park, you know, people would look at you like, who are you? Like they'd look at the uniform and I'm a park ranger. It's like, what's that? And you know, it's a lot of people have never visited a national park, and a lot of people, you know, even in San Francisco don't even know that they have a national park at the doorstep.
Yeah. Right.
So it's educating people. And of course, you know, people would look at you and they'd be like, oh, since when do park rangers carry weapons? And it's like, well, for a long time, let me tell you. So the only thing, you know, a lot of people who don't work for the Park Service, they're confused because, you know, law enforcement rangers wear the same uniform as interpretive rangers.
Yeah.
Wear the same uniforms as maintenance. So it's like being in a small town, like my little town, where the teachers wear the same uniforms as the police officers, who wear the same uniforms as public works employees. So it's trying to educate the public. Well, you know, the uniform is part of being a National Park Service employee. We wear it, but law enforcement officers, we have body armor, we have the duty belt, we're trained, you know, special training, blah, blah, blah. So that's what I hope my book was able to convey to people.
Right.
Just what a ranger goes through in his or her career. Yeah.
I'm hoping you're going to share now a couple of Ranger tales, I like to call them, that you wrote about in your book. And I sent you what my favorite ones were. So there's no obligation to tell those stories, but I'm hoping that you're going to tell a story or two.
I will tell you as many stories as you'd like.
All right. Hey, I'm ready.
Let me share with you and your readers. I know you already read this one, but it was getting high at Ocean Beach. So it already sounds good. It was a nice day out, and I was doing the Ocean Beach Dune Patrol, and pretty slow day, not a lot of people camping out there or anything. And I heard a couple other Rangers calling for backup, and they were on the Ocean Beach stairwells, and they were out with what they thought was a marijuana contact. So I ran back to my patrol car, drove up the seawall to where they were, and I got out, and the person that they were with, was walking away, and I'm like, everything okay? You guys code four? It's like, yeah, he had no marijuana on him, but it's like, we still smell this. And so I looked at I looked over in the beach, and the Park Service, they finally got to the point where they have fire pits, because before people would just light their fires right on the sand and leave the debris everywhere.
It's a mess.
Mm-hmm. It's a mess. Nails, pallets, broken glass. Oh, yeah. It's a mess out there. So this person I saw at one of the legal fire pits was just dumping stuff in the fire pit, and it was just creating all this smoke. And I'm like, I think that's our person right there. So the three of us, we walked out onto the beach, made contact with the guy, and he was literally throwing, clothing, pictures with glass, and
as you do,
fire. Yeah. And we're like,
why not?
Yeah, right. So we said, police officer, step away from the fire. You got any weapons on you? Blah blah blah. And then it was like, what the heck are you doing? And he's like, well, man, I just broke up with my lady, and I'm just getting rid of everything associated with her. And it's like, dude, wow. You can't do that. This is a national park. And then we look in the fire, and there's like a whole bunch of marijuana in there. And we're like, what? Okay.
Why would he burn that? Come on.
Because that was, that was their stash. So again, he was burning everything associated with his.
He was really sad.
He was sad. We felt sad for him too, right? So, one of the Rangers, his name is Mark. Mark went with him off to the side, started writing out a ticket, and we went light on him. We're like, we're going to give you a ticket for disposal of waste, right? So it was a cheap ticket, like $50 plus court cost, and give him a break on the marijuana. So Shannon, the other ranger that was there, Shannon and I started digging the marijuana out of the fire pit, right? So we were using our batons. There was like a stick.
You have to save it. It's evidence. Save it.
Yeah. So we were like saving the marijuana, doing, hey, that's what law enforcement rangers do, right? we got to preserve this evidence. So, so him and I, we're digging this stuff out. We finally, cut the guy a break, give him a ticket. We take the marijuana that we could find, put in a plastic bag. We go up to the seawall, and Mark is like, getting, putting the evidence together. And I noticed he's just like kind of walking back and forth, like he just can't concentrate very well. Well, Shannon was sitting there looking at the waves and just, with this wistful look on his eyes, just like looking and staring. And I'm like, and it's easy for me to laugh, but I'm laughing at everything. I'm just like I break down laughing, tears coming out of my eyes. And I finally told Mark and Shannon, I'm like, guys, we're high. And they're like, no. I'm like, yeah, we're like super high right now. So my first call was to the chief ranger. And I told her what had happened. And she just yelled right through, like, what? I'm like, okay, chief, like, we're okay. Don't worry about us. And she's like, okay. So the one person within the three of you that's the least high, get in the patrol car
and call
dispatch. You're out of action. You're not taking any calls. Okay. And she says, I did. And so, I was what I thought the least high of the three of us. So we drove to a coffee shop that's maybe 2 miles away. It's called the Art Bistro. And we sat in that coffee shop for probably 2 hours, just and the chief, it was her treat. So she finally compensated us for the coffee, the tea, the breakfast sandwiches that we're eating. And it finally got to the point.
What about Doritos? Like, did you order some Doritos?
No, but I had the munchies. I was so hungry. I was just like, I just wanted to eat anything that was there. So the ladies that run the coffee shop, their names are Ty and Goff, and they were just laughing because they could smell the dope on us. You know, it was over our uniforms, and I don't even know the other customers that walked in. They were probably like, "Okay, what a great exposure! If they hadn't met a park ranger before, now here's three park rangers who smell like dope. One is like staring at the buses driving, past on Geary, just looking at them. The other one can't sit still, and the other one's laughing." And it's like, and they also
they wanted their tax dollars back. What are my tax dollars going to?
I know, right? Well, it's a wonder they didn't call San Francisco PD on us. So long story short, we finally came down off our high, drove back to Ocean Beach. Three of us got in our respective vehicles, and I drove back to the ranger station. And of course, the first thing I had to do was go on to the workers' comp website and file an exposure claim. And, but I got to tell you, it's not all what it's cracked up to be. It's like, yeah, I laughed a lot and I got really hungry, but I had a splitting headache for like a day afterwards.
Yeah. Oh, that's so funny. I love that story. I that was one of why I recognize that's a hilarious story. Cause you just can't make this stuff up.
You can't. And I think all of us who've worked as park rangers, we've all had stories like that where it's like, is this a dream? Like, what the heck is going on, right?
Well, there was one more that I liked. Uh-huh. I don't know if you remember which one it was, about the something doesn't smell right.
Oh, yeah. So that one was, I was out on Ocean Beach dune patrol, and I'm looking for people camping illegally. And like I said, it's the end of the road, so we get the worst of the worst, that the people that end up either they're crashing after being rip-roaring drunk the night before, or they have warrants or whatever. We run into them, and I see this fella, he's sitting there in a sleeping bag and can't camp out there, right? It's national park, you got to go to organized campsites, or this isn't one of them. So I woke him up and I'm like, "Police officer, show me your hands," right? So he's like, kind of bringing his hands out slow. And I'm like, "Get out of the sleeping bag," right? And so he gets out of the sleeping bag, and I look down at his feet, and both of his feet, he had no socks on. They were both gangrene. So I was like, this guy's this isn't going to turn out good.
Right.
So, so I ran.
I can't say I've seen gangrene feet. I'm going to look that up.
No, it's horrible.
After we get off of this.
Yeah. My dad, before he passed away, he had been, trying to recover from strokes for like a decade, right? And at the very end, when he passed away, the rest of the family and me, we're pretty, thankful. It's like he was suffering so much. And, and of course, we found out that he had gangrene feet, that the doctor.
Sorry.
Oh, no, it's okay. But that's how I, got
recognized
to know
what
it looks like, right? So I mean, you see it in your EMT textbooks, but it's one thing to see it in person, and of course there's a horrible smell associated with it. Basically, it's just flesh that's dead, So anyway, he gets out of the sleeping bag, I notice the gangrene feet, and I run a once warrants check on the guy, and it comes back that he's a sexual registrant, hadn't registered in like a decade, right? And I'm like, oh my gosh. Right? And so, and this was a felony, original felony conviction that he had. So it's like, okay, you're under arrest, so hook him up, get an ambulance coming that way because of his gangrene feet. Well, I thought the guy smelled bad. I'm sorry, gangrene really stinks. But when we got him to the hospital, the charge nurse says, "You got to take him to the shower and he's got to wash." And I'm like, "Do I have to be in there with him?"
like, "That's not my job."
Yeah, right. So she's like, no. Just get there. There's like a curtain, pull over. You just get there because he's under arrest, right? And I'm like, okay, fair enough. Right. I'm not going to touch him, right?
Yeah.
So we get him in the shower, and I thought the smell couldn't get any worse. But
Oh, no.
He had defecated in the shower.
Oh.
And he was using the feces as soap, and he was like lathering it seemed like he was lathering himself, because when the nurse came running in and she's like, "What the heck is going on?" She ripped open the shower curtain, and I saw that. I'm like, "Oh my god." She's like, the nurse said, stop. Are you crazy? And he's just like looking at her. So it was like, oh my God. So we had to, we had to get in there and we had to clean him off and properly bathe him and everything. And the nurse helped me, but it was like, this is disgusting, right?
Yeah. So, another thing you don't think park rangers are going to have to do.
Right. And this guy was not a nice guy, you know, besides the felony, sexual molestation that he had of children. Mm. He just wasn't a very good person to be around, right? You know, and he had some mental issues and stuff like that. But all total, it's like, I don't want to be near this guy. Well, we finally get him washed, put him in some hospital gown or whatever. We put him into a bed, handcuff him, you know, to the side of the bed. And doctor comes in there and asks the question, no, are you having any chest pain? And he said, yes. And I'm like, really? You know, my initial thought was, seriously, after all this, now you're going to say that? Because, you know, like a lot of different parks, when you transport a person who's under arrest to a hospital, you're with that person until they get admitted into the hospital. And if you're lucky in an urban area, that's when the deputy sheriffs come in and take custody of the person. Well, that's what I was looking at. Like, I mean, I'm already just like really, really tired, you know, just like trying not to puke from the memories of the shower.
Yeah. Right?
So I'm like, okay, doc, what's the next step? And they're like, well, we'll do a series of blood tests. And of course, they did a blood test. Half an hour goes by and the doc's like, I think we got an issue here. We're going to take him down and get him a scan. So I get down there and, you know, I have to, you know, take the handcuffs off, obviously. And I get in the room where the technician's at. And I'm looking at as the scan's popping up, I'm like, oh my God, like, is that kind of what I think it is? And the tech's like, well, what do you think it is? And I'm like, that's a aortic aneurysm, right? It looks like you can see it from the EMT textbooks, right? And all the training
we took.
Like, it looks like a balloon ready to pop. And he's like, well, I'm not a doc. I can't say anything, but if that's what you think it is, I'll let you have it, right? And it's like, so,
oh, wow.
Oh, yeah. So within like a couple of minutes, the room is filled with doctors and surgeons, and they're all looking at it. And I just kind of politely get out of there because I'm like, you know, is this, you know, patient confidentiality and everything? Yeah. And I can't be there. But long story short, he was admitted to the hospital and he did pass. They didn't get to it in time, the aneurysm. So he did die in a hospital. Wow. And yeah. But that was quite the story with this guy. You know,
I don't really know how I feel about this ending.
Yeah, exactly. You know, that's the way I felt too. You know, he was a very not nice person, right? It wasn't, you know, but he died at least in a hospital. He didn't die. I mean, he could have easily died out there in the dunes and I would have found a dead body in a sleeping bag rather than a person alive. So at least maybe there was that little bit of, you know, someone kind of gives a damn about me, even though I'm maybe not a good person. So I won't get into his head like that, but I'm hoping there was a little bit of that, at the end, that at least he was in an environment where people were trying to save his life. So that's kind of the thing I took away from that whole thing. And it's just when you think that, you know, smells don't get any worse, it can get worse.
Well, I will say you're a very good storyteller because I got the complete visual again. And those were legitimate dry heaves that you might have been hearing, you might not have been hearing, but there were legitimate dry heaves and gagging going on. Well, so what is one story, or you can tell more if you want, but where you felt like you actually made a difference in someone's life? Because I do think that in general, that's what drives law enforcement and first responders and park rangers, especially just because that's, you know, seems would be what I know is we hope that we make a difference in someone's life. Yeah. So do you have a story where you felt like that was the case?
You know, a few of them, but I think the one that really, it still just resonates with me is it was close to Christmas and, you know, I'm driving southbound along the Great Highway by Ocean Beach Dunes and everything on the way back to Fort Funston. And it was a cold day, just, you know, gloomy, you know, it doesn't snow usually in San Francisco, but it just had that real gloomy look to it. Where you know doggone well that there's no one out there, right? You know, causing trouble. You just know it. It's just like no one's going to be out here. But I get to the Great Highway in Lincoln, and I don't know why. I just felt like I need to stop and get out of the car, right? And I it was just a weird feeling. So I called into dispatch. I'll be on foot patrol, Great Highway Lincoln, walking in the dunes. And I had only walked a short distance, and I found this this female, and she was sitting there just, the shivering was almost gone. She was dying of hypothermia, and she only weighed like maybe 90 pounds, maybe 100. So wow. Very, very, very petite person. So I knew I had a pretty serious, medical condition on my hands here. So it was like, I got to get her in someplace warm. So I called dispatch. And of course, when you think it's not a busy day, it kind of is. So all the ambulances for San Francisco Fire Department were all busy running other, more critical calls. So I'm like, I am not going to let this lady die here as I'm waiting for an ambulance, right? So I picked her up in my arms. I carried her back to the patrol car, put her in the front seat, turned the car on. And I said, would you like to listen to some music while waiting for the ambulance? And she's like, yeah, it's okay. And now the shivering's coming back. So it's working, right? The heat of the car is kind of bringing her back. So we're listening to Christmas songs. I give her my water bottle. I'm like, here, just drink the water. Here's a couple of snack bars I have and stuff. And it took probably, probably 30, 40 minutes for an ambulance to finally get there. And picked her out of the car again. I put her onto the gurney, and they put her into the ambulance. And I was getting ready to go, and EMT or the paramedic on board says, "Hey, she wants to talk to you." So I come over there, and they've got a warm blanket around her and stuff like that. Got an IV going before they're ready to take off. And she sticks out her hand, and I hold her hand, and she tells me she loves me, right?
Oh,
and I know, right? And I'm like, okay, just take care of yourself, all right? And I get back into the patrol car, and I just started just crying for 10 minutes, 15 minutes. I'm like, damn, you saved a person's life. And and we don't have any control, any of us, over what happens even that day, later that day or the day after. But for that particular day, just like the guy that I had arrested, taken to the hospital.
Yeah.
You just feel good that, you at least you cared about a person, and they probably felt like you kind of gave a damn about them, and you wouldn't just abandon them to the elements. I mean, I don't know.
Right.
I can't speak for other people, but I don't know. Were there any visitors that walked by her and just thought, oh, it's just a homeless person, whatever, right?
Right.
But that particular day, again, what made me stop, I don't know. And just being with her in the car, and just listening to Christmas music, and the whole, just everything thrown in, was just such an emotional moment. And I think about that incident. And I hope to God she's doing okay, that she got treatment. But you never know, right? But for that particular day, you made a difference in a moment, in a person's life.
I think that's wonderful. That's a great story. Thanks so much for sharing that.
Oh, you're welcome.
Then I picked up a couple of, I don't know if I would call this a theme or not, but there were a few times, at least three times, you wrote about getting kicked in the groin a lot. And
a dead guy. Yeah.
A dead guy?
Yeah, it was a dead guy. So you got to, probably anyone listening to your podcast, they're like, how in the world would this guy get kicked by? He's got a lot of good stories, but come on, by a dead guy. So I'm out on patrol, and this is by Fort Mason. Guy comes walking up to me and says, hey, there's a guy over there, in the bushes. He doesn't look right, or look good. And I was walking with a park police officer. So I'm like, okay, show me where this person's at. Well, I go over there, and guy was dead. Like, he was lying there with a hypodermic sticking in his vein, right? So it's like,
oh, wow.
Yeah, that's why he doesn't look good. He's dead, right? So we, I'm an EMT. I can't pronounce anyone dead, right?
Right.
he looked pretty dead. So I called dispatch, and I'm like, okay, you need to have the coroner come out here. We're out with what looks to be a deceased person. There's no pulse. They're not breathing. A little bit of mortis setting in and stuff like that. And like, okay. So San Francisco, they contract out with people who, do the body recoveries and everything like that. So the team that got sent out to me that particular day didn't have much experience, to say the least. I don't think they'd ever put a body in a body bag. So it was up to Park Police Officer Neil and me to put the guy into a body bag. Once the contract person said, "Yeah, he's dead. You know, here's a body bag," and I'm like, "Dude, like, aren't you going to help us?" And he's like, "No, I'm good." As it turns out, he was like petrified. He had gotten himself up the cliff where the body was, but couldn't make his way down. So that was his rationale. Like he just couldn't do it.
So, like the heights, being afraid of heights.
Heights, and he was afraid of falling. And you know, for me, I mean, I'm like, okay, like I've fallen down cliffs bigger than this. I'm like, dude, what do you know?
Yeah, what's your problem? I've been struck by lightning just a few times.
Right. So I'm like, okay, and I'm not gonna he's gonna feel the way he's gonna feel, right? I'm not I can't control what he's doing. So Neil and I stuff him into the body bag, and the head was pointed downhill. So Neil got the head. I was ending up with the feet in the body bag. Well, Neil was wearing the wrong shoes for climbing and stuff, right? And I'm wearing like whatever the Danner boots that they assigned to us, right? Which are good, you know, pretty good for sliding and stuff, prevent sliding. So Neil slid. He drops the head. Like I said, I'm holding the feet. The feet come swinging right up, right into my groin. So I'm like, So I dropped the legs. Thankfully, the body didn't go sliding down the cliff, right?
Yeah.
So Neil's like, dude, what happened? I'm like, I just got kicked in the groin. He's like, by the dead guy? And I'm like, yeah, like zip it, Neil. So that was the first time I got kicked in the groin. And of course, ice packs, you know, I got it, you know, loaded up down there to prevent swelling and everything like that. then the second time was by a bottle collector. He had this massive, massive collection of bottles. He was homeless and he had a massive campsite. So I contacted him and he had, like a felony warrant. So, you know, in the process of putting the handcuffs on him, he swings his heel up right into the groin. And So I threw him down on the ground, got the handcuffs on him, and backup got there. And we literally had to carry this guy up the hillside to get to where the patrol car was. He refused to walk.
Of course. So, you know,
the whole time I'm like, God, I'm in pain, right? So, of course, we have to take him to the hospital, and eventually the charge nurse said, "Hey, he's 5150, and you know you're gonna have to fill in the paperwork." Yeah. So, I had to do
and
that.
And can you share 5150 with some people who aren't from California?
I will. It's a welfare and institutions code. It's called 5150, and it's for a person who is gravely disabled. And that's kind of, you know, pretty flexible here, at least in the San Francisco Bay Area, who is gravely disabled, a threat to themselves or a threat to somebody else. And what you can do is you can detain. It's not an arrest. You detain a person on a 5150 welfare and institutions code. You take them into the whatever hospital is going to admit it, anyone with a psychiatric ward. And our go-to hospital is San Francisco General Hospital. And so you'd take him in there, and a good day, you know, they'd be there for 3 days, a 72-hour hold, and they get the treatment that they would need. Well, there's not a lot of bed space. So unfortunately, you bring a person in on the 5150 hold. They're usually a frequent flyer, so they've been through the process before. You know, the psychiatrist will say, "Hey, are you taking your medications?" "No." "Like, what are you taking?" "Oh, like whatever meth is usually the go-to, right?
Right.
Just something besides the prescribed medication. So doc would say, "You need to take your medication," and you know, they'd monitor the person for an hour or two and cut them loose, right? You know, it was so bad that I would drop the person off at San Francisco General Hospital on the 72-hour hold. By the time that I made it back to the office, and of course stopping for a mocha on the way, right? And to do my report, dispatch would call, "Oh, you know, the person that you detained, they're looking for their stuff." And I'm like, seriously? Yeah. They were in there for an hour or two.
Yeah.
And you know, and they
didn't, and sometimes they beat you back. They'll even beat you back to where you picked them up.
Yeah, they totally would. And so it was a revolving door. But so this fella, like, I had to take him to San Francisco General Hospital, get him checked in and everything like that. Then I had to tell my partner, "Can you drive me?" I didn't want to go to San Francisco General. Like, it was just known. Unless you were suffering from a gunshot wound or knife wound, don't go to San Francisco General. Now, it's changed. Wow. they have a new wing called Zuckerberg, and it's really state of the art. But my go to hospital, because I'd been so many times in San Francisco, was just go to the university hospital. It was better care. They saw you fast. So I had to wait.
And then you were there. You were their frequent flyer.
I was a frequent flyer there. And so, you know, I got there and they did the exam, gave me some ice packs. And it was like, this is getting old, like number two, right? Well, number three was my chief ranger kicked me in the groin.
What?
Right. And it's like, how does he still have a job? Well, his name's Randy. Long story short, it was a person suffering from a mental breakdown. He had assaulted a park police officer and a ranger, fell down a cliff, and was hiding in the bushes. I got there. I was the first on scene. The ranger, it was either the ranger was helping the park police or it was like mutual. They were both like stopping the bleed from, you know, like a bad abrasion on the scalp and stuff. So there was some blood involved. I'm like, are you guys okay? Yeah, we're okay. I'm like, where did he go? Well, he fell down a cliff. And I'm like, okay, I guess I got to go get him. So I climbed down the cliff, and I knew this guy from other contacts. So, you know, I was shouting out to him. I saw he was hiding in some bushes. And I'm like, hey, it's Ranger John. You know me. Come out of the bushes. Show me your hands, right? And so he comes out of the bushes, and he's holding a broken bottle. So I pull my pistol out, and I'm like, okay, you need to drop the bottle. Like, if you approach me any closer, I'm going to shoot you, right? And it's going to make me feel bad. So don't make me feel bad, right? Right. So, so I'm telling this to him to try to, you know, it's like, come on, dude, just drop the bottle. Don't make this any worse than it is. And finally, he's like, is that really you, Ranger John? And I'm like, it's me. It's, you know, my voice. Come on. So he drops the bottle. He comes out. I detain him. Well, now I got to get him up this cliffside that he fell. So instead of doing the right thing and waiting for, get a litter down there, get a rope team.
Yeah. Oh, yeah.
You know, mm-hmm. Oh, no. We're going to be park rangers. We're going to just, you know, bring them up the thing. So Chief Ranger Randy and I, you know, Randy is he's holding one part and I'm holding the other part. And and we're coming up the hillside and we make it okay. And then, you know, I put the guy back on his feet. Well, Chief Randy hits a big old tree branch, which flops up and hits me right in the groin. And I'm like, oh, God, you know, I almost collapsed down. I'm ready to puke, wow. Right? I mean, the pain is that bad. Well,
yeah.
Then they decide, oh, who better to, you know, escort this guy to the hospital than me, because I bonded with him. And I'm like, seriously? So I get an ice pack from the EMT. So I'm in the back of the ambulance with an ice pack on my groin talking to this guy. And this guy's apologizing to me. He's like, dude, I'm so sorry. Like that big guy, meaning the chief, right? Like the big guy just, he hit you in the groin. And I'm like, don't worry about it. And he's like, and he was like so concerned about me.
That's
and I'm
funny.
Like, you know, he's sitting there handcuffed in the bed and everything. Get him to the hospital, again, my frequent flyer hospital, the university, right? And he gets in, he gets the help he needs, you know, in the room. And I'm sitting outside and I got an ice pack to my groin and a nurse comes walking by and she says, are you okay? And I'm like, no, not really. I said, I'm in a lot of pain. And she's like, oh, you got kicked down there? And she's like, by that guy, I'm going to go in there and kick his butt, right? And I'm like, no. It was my chief ranger that kicked me. And she's like looking at me like, what? That's assault and battery. I'm like, no. I had to tell her the story, right? But but I'm waiting there like maybe 10, 15 minutes until they, you know, figure out what to do with the guy. And all these nurses are coming by. Are you okay? Are you okay? You know, bringing me more and more ice packs. And I've got like 5 or 6 ice packs down there right now in my groin. And it's like, oh, okay, well, you know, this isn't very pleasant, but it's nice to get the attention, you know.
Well, I've got a couple of takeaways from this, from talking to you today and reading your book. And one is maybe don't do boat patrol. That's a scary job. I did boat patrol too. Lightning scared me to death, but maybe don't do boat patrol. And the other thing is, I think just as a practice, you need a box of ice packs in your trunk of your car. So
I agree. Yeah. For any listener that's starting out in their law enforcement ranger career, I agree with you. Have a lot of ice packs. Don't go in the water when there's any chance of lightning. And
yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, that's scary. Well, I'd kind of like to close this out with any advice you might have or thoughts on just in general, like maybe a couple, one or two things about folks seeking help and taking care of their mental health.
Yeah, absolutely. So the first thing is don't give up. You go get help, right? And there's a lot of resources that are available out there for, you know, any type of help that you need with PTSD. You know, PTSD is you think you beat it and then it can come back. So that's why it's so important. Get the help that you need. Remember that, in it's covered PTSD and you're protected under the ADA. So never let a supervisor say, oh, you need to suck it up or whatever, get back out in the field, or, don't accept things that are taken away. If you have, like most Rangers, we all have like different certifications, right? And, don't let some supervisor or chief or whoever, superintendent, say, oh, we're going to take you off this, right? No, say, absolutely not. This is covered under ADA. I am getting treatment for this and you are protected. So do remember that. And of course, we all know exercise. We all know this, but do we really do it? The exercise, eat well, get the rest you need. But do talk with family and friends that you trust, right? Don't keep this internally. And if you don't have PTSD, read about it, read up on it, take classes. That way you can support a colleague who might be suffering from it, and you can be their advocate. Because, the Park Service is the Park Service. It doesn't care. Yeah. Like any organization, right?
Right.
They don't care. You're just one of, you can be replaced. So you do have to fight to get the help that you need. And you gotta be, your own best advocate, but it sure does help if you bring in some friends to help you in the process. That's the biggest thing. And of course, for those who don't know, you can call 988 now. You can text TALK, TALK, to 741-741. And then there's organizations. It really helped me after I got treatment at the post-trauma retreat was volunteering. I had one psychologist that told me is one of the best things you can do is, do something for another person without expecting anything in return. And that's altruism. And of course, the same psychologist, the best piece of advice too, and especially for a lot of people who are maybe just starting their careers, but even those who are ending the careers or close to it, remember, you don't have any control over what happens to you. You don't.
Right.
Right. If you're a magnet to trouble like I am,
sounds like it.
It's true. You're going to continue being a magnet. But what you do have control over is how you respond to whatever you're confronted with.
Yeah.
So, that's the biggest takeaway is just know that you're in control of that. Of course, there's different things you can do trying to, use the 5-4-3-2-1 technique of, things you can touch, see, smell, taste, hear. That kind of keeps you grounded, right? So it's just taking care of yourself, please. When we all first start out, in the Park Service, especially the Park Service, we're happy, we get that uniform in the box from Uniform Solutions or whoever the vendor is now. And we don't even wait to wash it. Usually we put the uniform on, we put the flat hat on, we're so proud of it. And, the first few years you're doing things that are super cool, you're having fun, but then of course, maybe you don't get the promotion that you want, or that, you don't become a supervisor, you're a GS9 still, which is nothing wrong with that. I was, but you don't get the things. You maybe get a complaint from one of the visitors, and that happens in your career. Maybe your supervisor does lay into you for something that you did or didn't do, right? And then all of a sudden, you start not liking the job anymore. And then you start doing the choir practice with your fellow Rangers of how this job sucks or whatever.
Yeah.
And then of course, if you have PT, and I'm saying this because that was me, then all of a sudden, it's like you don't even have the choir practice because you don't even want to talk to somebody else.
Right.
So it gets to a point where now you hate the job. And of course, after I got the treatment, I went back to not loving the job because the job can't love you back, but I went back to enjoying the job and to, you know, and to feel good about the service I was providing the public and protecting the parks. You know, I just, again, for anyone just starting out, please listen to that advice. And just get in there knowing, again, job doesn't love you, but you can enjoy, you know, your career and just know that it's you have the choice of how you react to any situation that happens to you, right? You have that under your control, right?
Yeah. Well, awesome. Thank you so much, John. And your book is an interesting and fun read. Where can people buy your book?
So you can look for it on Amazon. It is under Amazon only right now. And just look under Echoes of the Badge, Stories from a National Park Service Career. You can put in my name, John Goodwin, if you're doing a search in Amazon. And it's available for you in paperback right now, or you can get it free if you have Kindle, or ebook is, I think, 99 cents still. So it's definitely a very, very... it has, as you can tell from our podcast that I've been joining in on today, there's stories that are fun, stories that are touching. But I hope it makes a difference. That's been my goal. My whole career is just making a difference in other people's lives. So I hope it makes a difference in yours.
I think you have definitely succeeded in doing that.
Oh, thank you.
Well, there you have it. Echoes of the Badge, Stories from a National Park Service Career. And we'll just close out by saying, stay safe in wild places and watch out for the company you keep.